This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Chazal tell us in Yomid Afkav Chesamud Beis that Eliezer was a very, very great man. Avraham Avinu Zokin V'Yoshiv V'Yeshiva Hoyo. Avraham Avinu was an old man, a wise man, and he headed up a yeshiva. Shneema V'Avraham Zokin Bo B'Yomim. Yitzchok Avinu Zokin V'Yoshiv V'Yeshiva Hoyo. Yitzchok Avinu also was a wise man, and he headed up a yeshiva. Eliezer Eved Avraham Zokin V'Yoshiv V'Yeshiva Hoyo. And likewise, Eliezer, the Eved of Avraham, the servant of Avraham, he was also a wise man and a Rosh Yeshiva. So Chazal classify him together with Avraham, with Yitzchok, all of them as great Chachomim who were Rosh Yeshiva. Vayomer Avraham el Avdei Zekan Beisa HaMeshel B'chol Asher Lo. And it says, and Avraham said to his servant, to the elder of his house, who ruled over all he had, Amar Rabbi Lozer, Shemoshel B'toiras Rabbi. What does it mean he ruled over all he had? What was everything that Avraham had? It was his Torah. And Eliezer had mastery over all the Torah of Avraham Avinu. And we know that the Torah of Avraham Avinu included all the Torah that we have. It means Eliezer had total mastery of all of Torah. Can we imagine what caliber of Godol he was, how great he was? Not only did he himself have mastery of that Torah, but he used to be able to dip into the resources of Moshe and feed it out to others. He was able to teach Torah from the Torah of Avraham Avinu. That was Eliezer. Not only in Chochmah, not that he ruled over everything that Avraham had, but that he ruled over everything that he had himself. That Eliezer Eved Avraham had mastery over his character, had mastery over his Yetzer to the same degree that Avraham had. He was the same kind of tzaddik that Avraham was. So he had gadlus b'Torah, he had greatness in Torah to an extent similar to that of Avraham Avinu, and he had gadlus b'Yerushalayim, he had a character that was also as strong and as great as Avraham Avinu. So Eliezer was an exceptionally great person. And so it's strange how the Torah sometimes refers to him. When Avraham calls him to give him the mission of going to seek a wife for Yitzchok, it says these psukim that this chazal has been based on. Vayomer Avraham el Avdoi. Avraham said to his servant, Zakan Beisoi, the elder of his house, his Rosh Yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva of the household, HaMoshel B'chol Asher Lo, he who had mastery over all of his Torah, he who had mastery over his own Yetzer. That's how the Torah talks about Eliezer. And a few sentences later, Vayomer Elov Ho'eved, and the slave said to him, Ulai Lo Yisoyveh Ho'isho Leleches Acharai El Oretz Hazois. Maybe the girl will not want to come after me and come and live in Eretz Yisrael. What then? He just calls him Ho'eved. Nothing more grand, a title, than the slave. And because of that change of tone, Chazal have a harsh word to say about Eliezer at this point. And Chazal say, Vayomer Elov Ho'eved, and the slave said to him, why does it call him the slave? Hadu dichtiv Kanan beyodoi ma'uznei mirmo la'ashik ohev. Kanan, in his hand there are scales of deceit. And normally it would be translated, he loves to oppress. The Midrash translated a little differently. Kanan ze Eliezer. Which is the Kanan referred to in this pasuk? This man who has a false scale to oppress people with, that's Eliezer. Shoyo yoshev umashkil es bitoy ru'uyu hizu o'eino ru'uyu. Because he sat and calculated when Avraham said, go and look for a girl, a wife for Yitzchok, he began to weigh up. Maybe my daughter is fit for her, maybe she isn't. Let's figure it out. Let's try and calculate. La sheik ohev. It doesn't mean he likes to oppress. It means la'ashoik ahuvoy shel olam, to oppress the beloved one of the world, Zeh Yitzchok. Omar, he said, ulay lo yisoyve. Maybe the girl won't want to come. Ve'etein lo yisbiti, and I'll give him my daughter. Omar le ato oru uvni boruch. Avram said to him, Eliezer, you are cursed. You descended from Canaan, and you have been cursed by Noach, and my son is blessed. Ve'en oru misdabek v'voruch. You cannot have a shidduch between somebody who is cursed and somebody who is blessed. It won't work. Why such terribly harsh words about this great, great man, Eliezer? What did he do so terribly wrong? He thought to himself, it may be my daughter's fit. It's a logical assumption. He's the Rosh Yeshiva. He's the closest Talmid to Avraham Avinu. Yitzchok's looking for a bride. It makes a lot of sense that it should be Eliezer's daughter. So he works out. Good. Avraham wanted to be from Canaan, from his own land, from his own birthplace. Fine. He'll go and he'll look. But if there isn't anybody suitable there, maybe she's at least second choice. And the Chazal say, apply to him the posuk of Canaan beyodoy ma'ozne mirmo la'ashoik ohev. Canaan has false scales in his hands in order to oppress a beloved one. This is called oppression. This is called falsehood, deceit, theft. And secondly, Rashi brings this further on, because when Eliezer repeats the story to Betuel and to Lavan, and he tells them the whole story that Avraham gave him this mission to perform, and he says, "Va'omar el Aduni," and I said to my master, "Ulai lo yisele choisho acharoi," perhaps the girl won't follow me. And here the word ulai is spelled aleph lamed yud, which reads elai. And Rashi says on that, elai, you see, that says elai, bas hoy soloi le Eliezer. Eliezer had a daughter. Bahoyo mechaze limtsoi ilo sheyomer lo Avraham lifnes elov lahasiyu bito. And he was looking for an excuse for Avraham to say, why don't you marry your daughter to my son? My son is blessed, your daughter is cursed, you are cursed, and a cursed person cannot cleave to a blessed person. That's it. But Rashi brings it further on when he says Eli, but in this posuk he doesn't. In this posuk he says Ulai. So there is no indication in this posuk that he's done anything wrong yet, and he hasn't done anything wrong yet. He's only been weighing it up in his mind, and he suggests maybe, what's the oppression, what's the terrible thing? We need to analyze this medrash a little bit. What are ma'ozne mirmo? Ma'ozne mirmo are loaded scales. A person has a scale, and it's not set correctly. It's loaded to give favor to the seller. What's so particular about that, and why is he called, and at what point is he called using this loaded scale, using this deceitful scale? Not even when he makes the suggestion, merely by weighing up, the mere calculation, is she good for Yitzchok or isn't she good for Yitzchok, that's already Ma'ozne Mirmo. The first thing about Ma'ozne Mirmo is, about a scale that's loaded, is that you can't come right with it. No matter what the reading on the scale is going to be, it's going to be deceitful. So the scale, your person might come in and say, I want 1 kilogram, and you'll put 1 kilogram on the scale, and the scale will read 1 kilogram, but it won't be 1 kilogram. That's the nature of Ma'ozne Mirmo. That the reading on the scale, the reading on the instrument, bears no relevance to the truth. That's what Ma'ozne Mirmo. Ma'ozne Mirmo is something interesting. You know, there's all this white collar crime taking place in the country at the moment. Not only here, it's taking place everywhere, but here it's particularly disturbing at the moment. And one of the things that are interesting about it is that the people who indulge themselves in white-collar crime, as they call it, are not the kind of people who would walk into your house and put something in their pocket. They're not the kind of people who would steal your motor car. They're not the kind of people who would put their hands in your till and take out cash. They're not the kind of people who would come into your shop and take something off your shelves. So what's wrong? Well, if that means they're not thieves. But to manipulate the figures and to steal hundreds of thousands or sometimes millions of rand, that they're willing to do. What's the difference? This element in Ozne Mirim Loin, false instruments. And that is that before very long, the person operating them forgets that there's anything wrong at all. He gets into that, you come in for a kilogram of goods, and he puts a kilogram on, and he gives it to you, fine, you pay for it. And he gets into the routine. There is no clear act of theft. Only in the beginning when he sets it incorrectly. But that was years ago, that's now finished. Now he just carries on doing business normally. It in fact removes the ugliness of the crime. And that's what white collar crime is, and perhaps that's why they call it white collar crime. You can sit in the comfort of an air conditioned office, 50 floors above the ground, with your computer and with your telephones and with your nice leather desk chair and your enormous desk, and you can sit very comfortably and carry on business as normal without actually having to perform any ugly act, without actually having to confront your victim, without having to actually perform an act of theft. It's a kind of, when Dr. Tamari was here, he called it a kind of victimless crime. Because nobody's really suffering, it's just these big institutions and they've got plenty of money, they don't notice the difference. That's one element of it, that the white-collar criminal doesn't associate himself with the victim, but there's something else, he doesn't even associate himself with the crime. Because as you use ma'ozne mirmo, as you use false scales, you don't even realize, you're not even aware of the fact that you're doing wrong. I was talking to the Attorney General of the Transvaal about the Blank case. And I said, 8 years is a little bit stiff, isn't it? Because they didn't even ask for that. The judge gave a much stiffer criminal than a much stiffer penalty than the prosecutor even asked for. And he said, not really. For stealing a motor car, we give 4 years at least. Don't you think that for millions, 8 years is appropriate? And we discussed it a little bit, but then there was another element. And assuming it's the same value, let's say it wasn't millions, let's say it was the value of a motor car, should he be given the same penalty as the car thief, or should he be given a greater one or a lesser one? With this understanding of Mosne Mirma, he should actually be given a greater one. Because the danger is much greater. A person steals a motor car, it's true that he can become a hardened criminal. That's one thing. But let's say an ordinary person who's not a hardened criminal steals a motor car once. It's not likely that he's going to do it a second and a third and a fourth time. It was an unpleasant thing for him to do in the first place, if he's not a hardened criminal. But the white-collar criminal, it's not an unpleasant thing to do at all. He presses a few buttons on a computer screen. That's all. Nobody sees. Nobody knows. There's nothing unpleasant. It's not nice for an ordinary, decent sort of person. The white-collar criminals are ordinary, decent sort of people who go around and do some of the nicest people. For them to actually commit an act of theft would be very difficult. For them to break into somebody's house is not something they could easily do. For them to take something that belongs to you is not something they could easily do. But this becomes so much and so normal. In other words, not setting in process a system, a business system, which is inherently deceitful. It's not that each time you do something deceitful, but you set your business up in such a way that in the normal conduct of your business you are being deceitful. That's the problem of Ma'ozne Mirma. That you don't even realize you're being deceitful. You Marame, not only are you deceiving the victim, you're deceiving yourself too. You think it's all straight and it's all kosher. And that's the amazing part of business dishonesty, is that the person doing it doesn't see anything wrong with it usually. A person, a criminal who goes and he takes something that doesn't belong to him, he might try to justify it a little bit, but he knows it's wrong. But when we put in systems into our business, when the way we conduct our business is essentially not correct, and then we carry on and we do it, we start being completely oblivious to the fact that there's anything that's incorrect about it. That's Mosne Mirmo. That's business systems that are inherently not correct, that are fundamentally not right. So what's that got to do with Eliezer? Eliezer is a person who makes a speculation. He sat and he made the calculation, is my daughter fit for Yitzchak or isn't it? That's deceitful. What does it mean? That's Mosne Mirmo. Mosne Mirmo, let's now understand and apply our understanding of Mosne Mirmo. That means that he was following a system of reasoning which had to come out with a false answer. That's what a loaded scale is. It has to come out wrong. It doesn't matter how carefully you weigh it. And you can have a real tzaddik there. Imagine you put your scales false, and you go and you buy something from him, and he puts it and he counts it on carefully to see that you order a kilogram, that it's exactly a kilogram, and when it gets onto the needle, exactly onto a kilogram, he adds a little bit more. And he says to you with his righteous face, I don't want to do you out of anything, just in case, let's put a little bit more on. It's alright, don't worry, take a little bit more. Big tzaddik. He can afford to do that because the scales are fixed. Very easy. There's no way that you can come right, no matter how careful you are in the use of the instrument, your conclusion will be wrong. So it is in the case of Eliezer's calculations, no matter how carefully he calculates, his answer will be wrong. Because they're mosne mirmol, it's a loaded calculation, it's a calculation that can't come right. Which is quite a frightening thought. That means there is such a thing as a calculation which, no matter how careful you are, cannot come out right. Sometimes we calculate things and I've got to think it through carefully because the answer must be right. Sometimes there are calculations which you have no business to be making in the first place. Because if you're making them, the mere making them already guarantees that you cannot come out with a proper result. Cannot come out with a proper answer. And for example, the lovely example they always give to illustrate what business ethics is. And you know the famous one when the fellow standing in the shop and he sells something, the man gives him some money and he gives change and he realizes that he's shortchanged the customer. He comes to the rabbi and says, "I've got a problem in business ethics. I gave the goods, he gave me the money, I gave him the change, shortchanged him." So the rabbi says, "What's the shaila? You better go and give it back to him." He says, "No, that's not the shaila. The shaila is whether I tell my partner or not." That calculation, should I tell my partner or shouldn't I tell my partner, the calculation is already wrong. That's not the issue. If you're thinking along those lines, you will come out with the wrong answer. What will you come out? Either you'll come out with the answer, "I should tell my partner and we should share the stolen money," or, "I shouldn't tell my partner and I should keep the stolen money." But whatever answer you're going to come to is going to be wrong. The calculation is wrong. You shouldn't be thinking that at all. That's important to know. There are certain calculations we shouldn't be involved in. There are certain thought processes that we shouldn't be involved in. Because being involved in them inevitably will lead us to a false conclusion. Just as using an inaccurate instrument to measure, no matter how carefully you use the instrument, will inevitably lead you to a false conclusion, to an incorrect result. And why was this wrong? Why could Eliezer not make that calculation? What was wrong with it? He's got a daughter, she's grown up in the household of Abraham. Surely she's the most suitable. Surely that's quite correct for him to make that calculation. The answer is very simple. Avram gave him a psak. Avram said, "Asher loy tikach isho livni bidvei saknani." The starting point is a principle, a psak halocha. The psak halocha is, my son is not going to marry a girl of Canaanite descent. That's the psak. And that is the difference between Jewish calculations, between Torah calculations and any other calculations. In Torah calculations, we start with the answer. And we simply calculate how to get there. Why that is the answer. In other calculations, you start with a question, and wherever you land up calculating, you calculate. Not so in Torah. In Torah, you start, there's a psak. The psak is, "Asher li sikach isho livni mibnei saknani, asher anochi yeshev bekirbe." The psak halacha is, no Canaanite. If the psak halacha is no Canaanite girl, Eliezer has no right to even start considering whether or not she would be fit. That's not the issue. It's like taking a piece of treif meat and deciding what's the most appropriate way to cook it. And should you salt it and soak it, or shouldn't you salt it and soak it? The whole thing is wrong. Because the psak starts, it's treif. That's it. That's where it starts from. If it's treif, there's nothing to calculate. So it is. Avraham gave a psak. The psak is, my son will not marry a Canaanite girl. There is nothing to calculate. The calculation will lead to a false answer. What will you come to? You'll come to an answer. No, Avram can't, Yitzchok cannot marry my daughter because she's not suitable. That's not true. That's not accurate. She might be well suitable, but she's a Canaanite girl. You'll come to the answer, Yitzchok can answer, marry my daughter because she is suitable. That's also not right. The answer of the calculation will inevitably be wrong. And before we begin a calculation, we must satisfy ourselves that if we think correctly, there is a chance of coming out right. If there's no chance of coming out right, we don't even calculate. We just put that calculation aside. No, there's no point in calculating something where you don't stand a chance. So that is the Knan biyodoy ma'ozne mirmo l'ashrik ohev. Biyodoy ma'ozne mirmo shoyo yoshev u'mashkil is bitoy ru'uyo hi o enu ru'uyo. The mere calculation was already deceitful. There was already the germ of deceit in it, where he just couldn't come out right. Why did he make that mistake? Why didn't he hear the psak of Avraham just a moment ago? Avraham said, you have to swear by an oath, Asher lo tikach isho livni b'bnei saksnani. He realized the reason for the psak. The reason for the psak, he realized, was that the Canaanite people are cursed. And he believed he had graduated out of that already. He believed that he was yotzo michlal orur v'nichnas lichlal boruch. That he had managed to elevate himself out of the category of those people who were cursed and to graduate into those people who were blessed. Through his learning, through his Torah, through his dedication to Avraham, he believed he'd already got to that point. Which in fact happened soon afterwards. When Lavan says to him, Boi Baruch Hashem, Chazal say on that, Vayomer Boi Baruch Hashem, he says to Avraham, come in, welcome the Blessed One of Hashem. And on that Chazal say, at that point, Eliezer did elevate himself and did graduate from being an orur, from being a cursed person, to being a blessed person. It was only a few days later. So Eliezer was not far off the mark when he thought that he had graduated. He just hadn't quite graduated yet. There were still a few days to go. That was the only difference. So there was a mistake in calculation there at that point. Why did he make that mistake? Eliezer had an interest, obviously. He was looking for a shidduch for his daughter at exactly the same time as Avraham was looking for a shidduch for his son. And Eliezer was as worried about it as Avraham was. Eliezer also couldn't figure out who would be the right kind of son for his daughter. So the fact that Yitzchak was available and looking for a wife, it seemed to be the obvious thing. So he had a negiah, he had some kind of personal interest, as great as he was, he had that personal interest. And a calculation needs to be 100% God-centered, so to say, rather than ego-centered. When we're analyzing something, when we're looking at something, we need to look at it not from the point of view ever of what's in it for me. What's in it for me is one of those calculations that is like Ma'ozne Mirmo. It must lead you to a false conclusion. What's in it for me will not lead you to an answer to why you should do something or why you shouldn't do something. What's in it for me is actually an irrelevant element in the calculation. The issue is it right or isn't it right? In deciding whether it's right or wrong, sometimes what's in it for me comes into it. Depends what kind of a decision it is. But the decision-making process, our pialoch, is a very simple one. And that is, the center of the issue is the correctness of it, the rightness of it. Is it right or isn't it right? That's all. And we're living in a society, we've spoken about it before, even in religious society, and Pastor, there's very much of an American influence in that, where there's not anything in it for me, people just don't do things. It's bad enough that in business, you've got to motivate people in terms of what's in it for me. And when I started off the Business Ethics Institute, I naively assumed that people would be interested in it because it's a good thing. What can be wrong with it? Certainly with all the white-collar crime and so on, and this was before white-collar crime had become such an issue. I thought, well, it's a good thing. Surely people will be interested in it. There's no reason not to be interested in it. And I don't know, anybody who's involved in business should be interested in it. But it didn't take me long to realize that in business, people are interested only in one thing, and that's the bottom line. It's got to be profitable. You've got to be able to show a person that there's something in it for me. That's not good. So Baruch Hashem, it's not very difficult to show a person that there's something in it for him in doing that which is right, and that's what we're doing at the moment. But the whole world is operating not only in a business area, it's moving far beyond that, of a need. If you want to motivate a person to do something, if you want to get a person to shift his attitude or his viewpoint, you've got to show him what's in it for him, otherwise no shift will take place. If you want to sell something to somebody, if you want to sell an idea to somebody, there's got to be something in it for him. And it comes even to the point of children at chinuch. We've got an interesting discussion going on in the Beis HaMedrash at the moment as to whether we should pay children to take the children's services or we shouldn't pay children to take the children's service. And we've had children bargaining with us. They say, for 1 second, I can get more at another shul. And we've got different views, both among the children and among the adults, as to whether they should. The one argument is, after all, they put a lot of time and preparation, and we want them to put a lot of time and preparation into it. We want them to feel committed to the job, so maybe they should be paid. And the other viewpoint is, you know, what kind of chinuch is that? And if I'm not paid, I'm not going to do it. And if I'm not paid enough, and if somebody else offers me more, I'm going to go to where I can get a little bit more. When does there come a time when you say, I have received, and this is the way I would like to give back, because I want to, because it's right, because it's good? Where does that come? When does that start? Babysitting. You ask a child who you've had over to your house for meals, and her family for meals, week after week, and months after months, you say, could you come and babysit for me? You've got to offer her a fee. What's in it for me? What kind of chinuch is that? And that's the mozne mirma. When you start off a calculation of what's in it for me, the conclusion has to be wrong. Because you're starting off with the greatest magia of all. You're starting off with the greatest self-interest of all. You can't think straight when you're thinking about yourself. You can think straight when you're thinking about somebody else. You can think straight when you're thinking about the Ribbono Shel Olam. You can think straight when you think abstractly about what is right and what is wrong. Then there's a chance you'll come out with the right answer. But when you're thinking about what's in it for me, what chance is there of coming out with the right answer? And if doing the right thing has got nothing in it for you, then what? And if doing the right thing in fact is going to cost you a little bit, then what? I've been discussing also recently in these business ethics issues the question of rewarding people. Same issue. And the importance of rewarding people, we've discussed it before in Shiurim, how very often when people retire, they start going downhill. And that's even people who've got hobbies. So people think that the reason that people go downhill after they retire is because they get bored. It's not so. Even people who've got very active hobbies and interests in charity work also start going downhill. What's the difference? What's changed? They're not being paid anymore. He said, what do they need to be paid for? Some of them are millionaires, and they still go downhill. They don't need the money. So what is it in being paid? So we've discussed before, it's important to be paid. And then the argument is put, yeah, but they're paid in other ways. They're paid with COVID, they're paid with recognition, they're paid with gratitude. There is something inadequate about non-material forms of recognition. There's something inadequate in that. What's inadequate about it is, it's very nice, I do a job for you with a lot of mysterious nefesh and a lot of application, and you're very grateful, and you write me a beautiful letter, and you give me a lot of cover for it. That's very nice. What's missing? What's missing is that the gratitude you're showing me doesn't cost you anything. It's very easy to be grateful if you don't have to put your hand in your pocket and take out of your time or take out of your money. And it's very easy to be grateful. And at the end of the day, the dignity of a person is upheld by saying to that person, I value your work so much that not only am I grateful to you, not only am I willing to show you COVID, but I'm even willing to put my hand into my pocket and at my expense compensate you for your time in an expression of the value I have for it. It's a different kind of thing altogether. That's the nature of reward. That's the nature of showing a person that he counts. That's the nature of showing a person that he matters. And so sometimes doing the right thing costs you. Doesn't matter. Sometimes you have to put your hand in your pocket. Not only is there nothing in it for you to do the right thing, but sometimes you've got to take out of your own to do the right thing. Sometimes you've got to give tzedakah. It costs you, hurts a little bit, but it's the right thing to do. Sometimes you've got to pay a little bit extra for kosher food or for particularly kosher food, but it's the right thing to do. Sometimes you've got to pay a little bit extra for a Torah education, but it's the right thing to do. And so you can't always look at things in terms of what's in it for me. Because if that's the angle to one's system of calculation, that's mozne mirmo. That's a loaded scale. If your system of reasoning is what's in it for me, your answer will be wrong without any question. You'll come up making false decisions. You'll end up doing things which are not good for you and are not good for anybody else because the scales are wrong. And even if you're reading the instruments correctly and you're getting the right readings from the instruments, the actions that that calculation will lead you to are not going to be the right actions. Because the method of reasoning is not what's in it for me, but what is right. And if Yitzchok would have forgotten about, if Eliezer would have forgotten about himself and his daughter, and wouldn't have thought one little bit about what's in it for us, but would have thought only what is the right thing to do, then his view would have merged totally with that of Avraham Avinu, and he would have understood that the right thing to do is to get the girl to follow him. But the second part of the Medrash is also very difficult. What happened? Do I have to start again? The second part of the Medrash is also difficult. La'ashoik ahev, he loves to oppress. La'ashoik, I like it when it sometimes doesn't come out. There's got to be some risk to not coming to the shiur. There's got to be some risk. If you knew for absolutely sure that there was always going to be a tape available, who would come? The only reason everybody comes is because maybe the tape won't come out, and then that's the problem. That's also, you see, Mervyn, that's also the difference between coming to a shiur and getting a tape. Coming to a shiur is putting your hand into your own pocket and saying, I'm also willing to give up the time to come. Getting the tape means I want to listen to it in the car while I'm driving in a way that doesn't cost me anything. That Rabbi Lappin has to spend his whole Shabbos preparing the shiur, that's his business, that's fine. If he's meshugah, so is I meshugah. I'm not prepared to spend any time on it at all. I want a tape that I can sit in my car while I'm driving, and instead of getting bored, I can listen to Rabbi Lappin droning on. It's more interesting than the traffic, at least. That's the... Did that part come out on the tape? What's La'ashoik Ohev? La'ashoik Ahubo Shalilam. To oppress the beloved one of the world. What's the big oppression? And it doesn't say he planned to oppress. He contemplated oppressing. He might have oppressed. Doesn't say that. To oppress. What was the act of oppression? Omar ulay lo soivev etin lo izbiti. All he said was, maybe she won't want to come. Maybe that's all he expressed, the possibility. Says the Medrash, that's La'ashoik Ohev, that's oppressing Yitzchok. What's oppressing Yitzchok? He hasn't found the girl yet, he hasn't left yet, maybe she will come. What's the oppressing? And if she doesn't want to come, is it he who oppressed Yitzchok, or is it the girl who oppressed Yitzchok? Why is that oppressing Yitzchok, just to say, maybe the girl won't want to come? And here, we have a very important principle. That if one understands properly, can and should change one's lives. I think you should turn it off again, they don't deserve to hear the principle. Imagine what a frustrating tape that would be then, huh? We discussed last night that the way we normally look at the process of progress and of life is that when a vacuum needs to be filled, we find the resources to fill it. Until there's a vacuum, we carry on normally. When there's a need, we fulfill the need. And we manage to get together the most amazing resources to fill that need. Things that we didn't even know we had. Normally life just carries on until there's a need, until there's an urgency. When there's an urgency, we pull ourselves together and we're able to be unbelievably resourceful to be able to meet the challenge created by that vacuum. But we said last night that that's not the way that the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted the world to function. The method of the world's functioning is Vezorach Hashemesh Uvo Hashemesh, which Chazal said in the Medrash at the beginning of the parasha, is Ad Shelo Yashkia Kodesh Baruch Hu Shimsho Shel Tzadik Umazriach Shimsho Shel Tzadik Chaveiro. That before one tzadik dies, there's already the next one is born. The sun rise in one point on the globe precedes the sunset in another, on another point, figuratively. That it's necessary for the sun to rise before the sun sets somewhere else. That the shifting of the sun is not to fill a vacuum. It's a dynamic all of its own, and it's only when there's a sunrise that a sunset can follow. And we talked about growth last night, and that growth means moving off from the past, leaving behind where one has been and working towards the future. But that there's a tremendous depressiveness in going towards an unknown future. Saying goodbye to the past when you don't know what the future is, that's terribly fearful. It's necessary to define the future first before you can say goodbye to the past. Imagine taking a child out of primary school and the child says, what do I do next year? They say, oh, we'll figure it out, we'll find something for you to do next year. That would be very insecure for the child. The only reason the child celebrates leaving primary school is because he knows he's going to high school. The only reason the child celebrates leaving standard 8 is because he knows he's going into standard 9. 9. But after that school process and university, if a child goes to university, is over, where each step is clearly mapped out. When you finish this, you start this. When you finish that, you'll start the next thing. Then all of a sudden the child is thrown out into the world and the mapping stops. Now you just, you know, just go. Do it, fine. And that's very insecure. That's very difficult for a person to handle. And so he builds himself new routines. And usually the routine inhibits the further growth because he's not able to move forward. He needs to be able to release his past. He needs to be able to release and move into new areas in order for growth to take place. But in order to be able to release the past, we said last night, it's important to have a vision of the future. If you don't have a vision of the future, you cling to the past inevitably. Leonard quoted this morning, the pasuk of Ve'ozov ish es oviv ve'esimoi ve'dovak ve'ishtoi. There comes a time for a man to leave his mother and father, contrary to the view of many men, and to cleave to his wife, to establish a new relationship that requires a shift. It requires a move away from Oviv Ve'imoi and a move towards Ishtoi. But you cannot have that move away before the wife is in place. Moving away from a father and mother is only in order to be Dovak Ishtoi. He's got to see the wife on the horizon at least. He's got to see the vision of the creation of a new family. Until he has that vision in front of him, he cannot say goodbye to his past. He cannot leave the relationship with his mother and father that inhibits the progress into the next stage. And so we discussed that is the nature of growth, that is the nature of the Bria. That's how the Ribbono Shel Olam runs the world. That not vacuums aren't created. It's destructive to create a vacuum. When a vacuum is created, negative things fill the vacuum, not positive things. If you leave the lawn unattended, weeds come onto the lawn. It doesn't just start good. But if you plant lawn, it pushes the weeds out. There has to be, the positive has to be planted. The vision has to be there. And once you've got the vision, you can start leaving the past and you can move into the new area. Avraham had a vision. What is the vision? Ki el arzi ve el moladati telech. My vision, says Avraham Avinu, is of you, Eliezer, my trusted Talmud, going back to my land, ve el moladati, into my birthplace, ve lo kachto isho livni liYitzchok. And my vision is there you will find the suitable girl who will be a wife to Yitzchok, and you'll bring her back to Eretz Canaan. That's my vision. And he communicates that vision to Yitzchak. He communicates that vision to Eliezer. Share that vision with me so that you can go with that same mission, with that same single-minded dedication to the fulfillment of that mission, and to the achievement of that vision. And what does Eliezer say? Ulai lo yisaveh, maybe it won't work. That kills the vision. When you start with a maybe it won't work, there is no vision. And if there is no vision, there is no mission. And if there is no mission, there is no purpose. And everything collapses. That's the cynic who says, Ulai loy soyve. Maybe it won't work. Who says it will work? The answer is, I have a vision. And if I have a vision, it will work if we apply ourselves to it. If you have that vision too, it will work. If you start with the ulais, if you start questioning whether it can work or not, you destroy the vision. And that is La Sheik Ohev. Who suffers? Yitzchok suffers. Why does he suffer? Because the girl won't come? No. Why does he suffer? Because you won't be successful? No. He suffers because you've damaged the vision. And if you've damaged the vision, of course the girl won't come. If you don't have the vision, you won't be able to motivate the girl to come. If you don't have the vision, you won't have the belief in it to make it work. It's not possible. We're looking at something new, we're looking at something revolutionary, going back there and being a girl to Eretz Canaan, to marry into the household of Avraham. This is all new. She doesn't know what Avraham is, she doesn't know what Yiddishkeit is, she doesn't know what we're building up over here. You're going over to paint a picture of what we're building, of what our yeshiva looks like, of what our community looks like. That's what you're doing. And you've got to be so confident in it. You've got to be so clear about it. You've got to visualize the girl and you've got to visualize her wanting to come. Yes, I've been trying to work out what's the difference between a good salesman and a salesman who isn't any good. And for years I haven't been able to work it out, and I've made such wrong decisions about employing people. People that should be so good and they're so bad, and people that really have nothing to them and are so good. What is it? The ulai makes the difference. A man who walks into his prospect with a vision of what this man is going to invest in, what this man is going to buy, that's the salesman, the man buys. The man who walks into his prospect with a ulai, maybe he won't be in, and if he's in, maybe he won't feel like seeing me, and if he sees me, maybe I won't have the right goods, and if I have the right goods, maybe my price will be too high, and if my price is too high, even if my price isn't too high, maybe he won't want to buy. Forget it, don't even bother getting in. If you don't share the vision, there isn't a chance of crossing that bridge. That's what leadership is. That's what breaking barriers is. That's what progress is. That's what growth is. There are some who've got it, and there are some who don't have it. And the ones who don't have it are nebuch. That's all we can say. It's poshut, it's a nebuch. They are committed to being stationary. They are committed to staying where they are. They are committed to being unable to make a meaningful move. They are committed to being unable to motivate anybody else to make a meaningful move. It's terribly tragic. They have the mentality of the eved. The slave who can only see in front of him. What's my job? I'll do it. That's all. But to go and to motivate, to have a vision of something that doesn't yet exist, and to make it exist, that's leadership. That's not avdus. And Avraham, in trying to make Eliezer reach that point, and I wonder whether part of the exercise here isn't to encourage the graduation of Eliezer from avdus to chayrus. Because at what point does he really become free? Later on he becomes free when he goes through with it. When he actually goes and he is able to motivate. That's the point at which he becomes free. And perhaps had he not said ulai, perhaps had Eliezer not said ulai, maybe it won't work. Perhaps had Eliezer said, sure, what a wonderful idea, I'm going to go and get this girl. Perhaps at that point he already would have come out of Boruch, out of Oru, and into Boruch. And Avraham Avinu says to him, you're Oru because of what he says here, ulai. The fact that you're starting with your pessimism, the fact that you're starting with your questioning, the fact that you're unable to share that vision, that means you're still in heaven. And there's no way your daughter can marry my son. That's the indication that you're still in heaven. And at what point does he realize the whole thing? Eliezer himself doesn't even realize what's happening until there's no personal involvement. When I said ulai, I was really saying Eli. When I said ulai, I meant Eli. I didn't realize it until now. What made him realize it? The fact that there's now no chance of his daughter marrying Yitzhak. There's no chance of his daughter marrying Yitzhak. He's able to look at it objectively. Once he's able to look at it objectively, he sees what's really happening. And that's the difference. That's the Ma'ozne Mirmo. The Knan Beyodo Ma'ozne Mirmo. La Sheik Ohev. This is such a self-defeating posuk. It's a mode of functioning that we often get into, which is so self-destructive. Both sides of it. The Ma'ozne Mirmo, calculating incorrectly. Calculating without the vision. Isn't that what it means? The vision was the psak. The psak is, go to my land, ki el arti ve'el moladati telech, ve'lokachto isho livni liyitzchok, that's the vision. And lacking that vision starts a calculation which leads to la shoik ohev, leads to oppressing yourself, other people, it leads to oppressiveness and it leads to depressiveness. Functioning, reasoning without the vision. Thinking is fine, calculating is fine, but there has to be a vision there while you're calculating. Let's give that same example. It's all very well for the salesman to stand outside the office of his prospect for half an hour, figuring out how he's going to approach the sale. How am I going to open? What am I going to put to him? What argument am I going to put to him? What am I going to answer when he says this, and when I say this, and he says that? How am I going to handle that? That's the calculation. And that calculation is fine, it's a kosher calculation. Provided one thing, that the vision is there. And the vision is signing the order. He can see it in front of him. He can see the prospect. He can see the client getting enthusiastic.
He can see the service he's providing for the client. He can see the value in what he's providing for the client. He sees the client with a smile on his face, taking out his pen to sign the order. He sees it all in front of him. He's just calculating how to get there. That's not Mozne Mirma. That's a scale which is set accurately. But when you're calculating and you don't have the vision at the end of the calculation, you don't know where you're calculating to. Let me think, is the sale going to work or isn't it going to work? You start with that, for Fallon, it's not going to work. You're not going to do yourself justice. That's not the right calculation. And that selling image applies in every other area of our lives, because everything we do is selling. Selling is communicating. Selling is motivating. And whether you're selling something to yourself, sometimes you have to sell to yourself the idea of giving tzedakah. You've got to sell to yourself. You've got to motivate yourself. Sometimes you've got to sell to yourself the idea of going to a shir, even though you're tired, sitting down and revising a piece of Gemara. Sometimes you've got to sell to yourself to do an act of chesed, even though there are other urgent things that you've got on your agenda at that particular time. It needs to be done. You need to sell it to yourself. Sometimes you've got to sell things to other people. Ideas, thoughts, all sorts of things. Selling means communicating. Communicating with yourself, communicating with others. Selling doesn't actually mean communicating. Communicating is a word that people use a lot nowadays. Selling means successfully communicating. There's a big difference. Communicating and successfully communicating. If you have successfully communicated, you have concluded a sale, no matter what it is. And communicating successfully means seeing a vision. I can see the result. Not only do I know where I'm trying to get, Eliezer knew where he was trying to get, but there was an ulai. Maybe it won't work. If maybe it won't work, don't even start. Don't waste your time. If maybe it won't work, you're the wrong person for the job. Go and do something else. There's the lovely story my uncle tells me. He was running a big business here, and they imported salt and hot trays. First time salt and hot trays hit the country. And it wasn't going well at all. Nobody was buying salt and hot trays because they were very expensive compared to the imported, to the local equivalent of just a piece of metal and an electric plate. And there was a young man who he'd employed, had just done a BCom, a son of a friend of his, and his father had asked him please to give the fellow a job. And he did so. And this fellow came to my uncle, who was a very, very successful businessman at that time, and said, Mr. Rappin, I know you might not agree with what I'm going to tell you, because you see, you haven't been to university, I have a BCom, but your business is going down the hill, you're going to be bankrupt very soon. And he said, why? That's interesting. He said, because these salt and hot trays can't sell. He said, if these salt and hot trays can't sell, you're the wrong person for the job and you're fired. That's all. But now he's going to find a salesman for the salt and hot trays. So he took the guy who was in the storerooms. Hello from the back. Here's another example of a person who's supposed to be a hot salesman and can't sell a hot tray. And you take the guy from the stores. And he said to the fellow from the stores, look, we don't have a salesman. All the salt and hot trays are sitting there. You better go and sell them. So the fellow walks, takes his salt and hot trays and off he goes. Walks into the first place and offers the salt and hot trays for sale, and the prospective customer says, are you crazy? That price for a hot tray? Who's going to buy? I can't. Nobody's going to buy anything at that price. He says, look, I don't know your business, Mr. So-and-so. I'm sure you know your business better than I do. I can just tell you one thing. This is my first day selling them. I've been in the stores up until now, and all I know is that in the stores we couldn't keep up with the sales. We just couldn't keep the salesmen properly supplied. I says, really? Give me 10. What was it? It was a vision, that's all. One had a vision, maybe it won't work, maybe it's too expensive, it's got to compare, so he couldn't sell. The other one had a vision that they could sell, so they sold. That's all it is. If there's a vision, you'll find the way. If there's no vision, you won't find the way. Of course, there is such a thing as having an unrealistic vision. You can have people who think they're Mashiach, and they've got a vision. That isn't going to work either. Those are people who are sick, they have a problem. But provided the vision is within the bounds of reality, it doesn't have to be within the bounds of normality. If your vision is going to be within the bounds of normality, you're also terribly restricted. If your vision is going to be bound by what normally goes, by what is regular, you're going to be terribly limited. You're not going to be able to break any new ground. Normal was that people shouldn't buy salt and hot trays. That's what was normal. The first salesman was right. He had an ulai. Because he couldn't see beyond normality. But it's not unreal. The vision is not out of reality. It's not out of the bounds of reality to be able to do so. And the little man who had no selling experience and didn't have a BCom and came from the packing room, he could sell because he had a vision. That was the only difference. And Eliezer, Avrom picks out in Eliezer already, if you're going to start with ulai, We're finished before you go. So get that out of your mind. There is no ulai. And there's no benefit to you in the ulai. And there's no way my son is going to marry your daughter. Once there's no way my son is going to marry your daughter, there's no ulai in Eliezer's mind anymore. Now he's got the vision. What was interfering with the vision? His own midas at the end of it. His own feeling of self-interest interfered with the vision. That's what it is. And so the ma'ozme mirmo that we have is our own self-interests. And the ma'ozme mirmo is making calculations without seeing the vision before we start calculating. And the result of that is la shrek ohev. We land up doing, short-changing ourselves. We land up not being able to achieve what we deserve to achieve. Not being able to achieve what we're competent to achieve. That's what lands up happening. And that's a terrible tragedy to shortchange ourselves. There's no need for it at all. We need to have that vision clear. When we start a sugya of Gemara, we've got to have a vision of what it's going to be like to master the sugya. When we sit down to a shir, we've got to have a vision as to what it's going to feel like to complete the shir. When we do a piece of business, we need to understand and have a vision of what it's like to complete that piece of business. Any project that we're doing, whether it's a lady baking a cake in her kitchen, or it's a person working on a business deal, or on a professional project, or on a piece of Torah, or on helping his child with homework, it doesn't matter what it is. You've got to have a vision of what lies at the end of it. You've got to see that in front of you in order to do it properly. When you're raising your children, educating your children, you've got to have a vision of what they could be at the end of all that. Without that vision, it's an ulai, maybe it will. Once you start with maybe, you're finished. There is no vision, and if there is no vision, there's no calculation. The calculation is ma'ozne mirmo. You're working with fiddled balances. You're working with loaded scales. You can't come right if the vision is absent. Only when there's a vision there is the calculation correct. Is the ulai absent, and are we guaranteed of some kind of siyata dishmaya and some kind of success if the purpose of our project is one which is right and one which is correct?